TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. David Quammen, is the coronavirus the byproduct of human behavior? In interview with Omo Parenti, April 23, 2020. In his seventh week of sheltering in place in Milano, Italy, the filmmaker Omo Parenti called the science writer and explorer David Quammen. He was sheltering in his home in Bozeman, Montana. Omo had read Quammen's 2012 book, Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, and he asked Quammen how he was able to predict 8 years ago the rise of the coronavirus pandemic. Omo Parenti is a member of A Thing By, a collective of young filmmakers based in Milano. David Quammen has won many awards for his books and magazine articles, including from the National Association of Science Writers. His work with National Geographic is best known. It has taken him on many difficult treks through the wild, such as chronicling J. Michael Fay's 2,000-mile survey hike through the forests of Central Africa, the Mega Transect. The conversation begins with David Quammen turning his computer sideways. He reveals a huge glass shelter in the sunlit corner of his study.
There's my snake over there in the tank. That's Boots the Python. He's sleeping right now.
Do you have other animals or just
the python? We have, my wife and I live in this house with two dogs, a cat, and this python. So that's our family.
That's amazing. I know that it would take 500 pages to explain this, but do you think you could walk me through the main information that you had and used to deduct that this next epidemic was going to be the next big one?
Right. Yes. Some people have said, oh, nobody saw this coming. This was unpredictable. That's just not true. The scientists saw this coming. The scientists that I was talking to 10 years ago when I researched spillover saw this coming in different pieces with different levels of probability. But if you took the consensus of the scientists that I talked to, the consensus would be this. Is there going to be a next big pandemic, a next big one, as I call it in the book? And they would say, yes, there will be a next big one. It'll be caused by a virus. That virus will come from an animal. What kind of an animal? Well, from a wild animal. What kind of a wild animal? Well, very possibly a bat. What kind of a virus? Well, a virus of the sort that evolves quickly, meaning maybe an influenza virus or a coronavirus. How would this virus pass into humans? Well, by contact, some kind of close contact between the wild animal and humans, or possibly through an intermediate animal. Where might that happen? Well, possibly somewhere where humans have contact with wild animals, including live wild animals, such as a wet market. Where? Well, possibly in China. So that was there. That was what I was hearing. That's what I put in my book. Was that predicting this? Well, to a pretty close degree, yes. Viruses are always unpredictable, particularly viruses that evolve quickly, like coronaviruses. They don't evolve as quickly as influenzas, but they evolve relatively quickly. So parts of this are unpredictable. But to me, the most unpredictable part of this whole crisis is how unprepared we were, many countries, Italy, the United States, for this event that the scientists warned us about with such accuracy.
Would you say that the information that was made available to you was also probably available to people who are in charge of making decisions?
Yes. This information was available. It's not just that I had private conversations with scientists 10 years ago and had the privilege of hearing this secret information. This was not secret. This was being published in scientific journals. Scientists were talking about that, not just to me. I've been talking about it as loudly as I can since my book was published in the U.S. in 2012, 2013 in Italy, I think. And this is all in journal papers, scientific publications, and the public health leadership in most countries knew about this, not just the scientists. So there were people in government, in higher levels of government. For instance, in the U.S., there was a directorate of our National Security Council devoted to pandemic preparedness. They knew about this. the people who led that knew about this on the National Security Council. What happened? Well, they knew about this. They were talking about this for years in the past. And then beginning with the Donald Trump administration, that directorate was closed down. Donald Trump didn't want to hear about this. He didn't want to spend money hearing about this. He didn't want to spend money being prepared for this. Likewise, at another American agency, the U.S. Agency for International Development, there was a big program designed to look for new dangerous viruses and create warning systems and response systems. That was closed down. So, yes, this information was not just available to political leaders. It was bouncing off political leaders for years in the past, and action, appropriate action, was not taken.
So you think it was mostly economical, like it was related to the economics of preventing the outbreak mostly?
Yes, it was, because political leaders don't like to spend money on something that might happen or might not happen during their term of office.
And I'm assuming that that's because it's inefficient to campaign about something that might not happen. It doesn't votes as much as other themes that might not. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And almost calling it inefficient is polite. It's risky for a politician to spend a lot of money on a program to defend against something that might happen, and then he's up for re-election 3 years and it hasn't happened, and his opponents are criticizing him. You spent, you know, X billions of dollars on pandemic preparedness and we didn't have a pandemic. Politicians are scared of that. They don't want that to happen. Although we spend money on missiles and nuclear weapons and battleships and things like that, great weapon systems, we spend money on those, huge amounts of money, and we hope that those won't be used. We hope that those won't be necessary, and we're happy. We call it deterrence. Well, we need deterrence against pandemics too.
It's interesting because it makes you think that our politicians almost spend more time campaigning to stay where they are than they do doing their work.
Excuse me, Olmo, did you say our political systems are flawed? Oh my God.
It's funny.
There are flaws. There are some flaws in our political systems, and not just in our political systems. Donald Trump was elected. So a lot of the fault lies on us, the American public. It lies on all of us because we haven't managed to educate the American electorate to critical thinking, to be able to see the difference between lies and reality and demagogic candidates and real leaders. You know, it was Winston Churchill, I guess, who said that democracy is the very worst system of government in the world, except for all the others. And we're seeing that.
When 9/11 happened, a single event on one side of the planet managed to change all security protocols in all airports of the planet. Ever since 9/11, whether you board a plane from China or the US or Europe, you get screened before you even get to the gate. And when you get onto a plane, the pilot's cabin is locked, which is something that we weren't doing before. Why was it that something like SARS in 2003 didn't achieve the same level of global cooperation on safety measure, for example?
Well, you make a very good point. SARS in 2003 was one of the warnings. It was a serious warning. It wasn't just an outbreak that killed 800 people around the world. It was a coronavirus. There was also MERS in 2012, another coronavirus coming out of the Arabian Peninsula with a high case fatality rate, but not so transmissible from human to human. And yet MERS got to South Korea in 2015 with someone coming back from Saudi Arabia, and it killed quite a few people in South Korea. Is that the reason that South Korea was better prepared than most countries for this? Maybe. But nothing like 9/11. You're right. However, this event should at least have the impact of 9/11 in terms of global preparedness. And as you rightly say, our airport safety controls, security controls, they're a form of preparedness against an event that might or might not happen. But you spend money and you cause people to go to trouble, standing in lines to go through airport screening. Millions of human hours spent on airport screening and a lot of financial resources to protect against the possibility that something might happen again, something as horrible as 9/11. And that was one bad event in one city affecting all the world. We should be ready to do that after this, once we get through this. We should use this event and learn from it. We're crazy if we don't act upon this event once we've got it under control.
Part of me thinks that had SARS happened in the United States instead of southern China, we would be seeing a different world right now, because it almost feels like we consider that part of the world too far from us culturally and physically. And had SARS happened in the United States, maybe even the World Health Organization would have acted differently on safety measures that every hospital in the world would have had to follow, the same way we did for 9/11.
It's a very good point, Omo, and you're very keen on this. And if I talked about it much more, I would give away my entire New Yorker piece.
My next question is about a lot of the epidemics and diseases that you describe in your book. And one way or another, in a lot of these diseases, it seems like patients end up facing some respiratory issues at some point. Now, this would make it sound pretty obvious that at some point, if we want to cure these people, we're going to need machines like ventilators in our hospitals. Why do you think there was such a big fear of running out of ventilators for patients if this is something that we could have predicted, we could have expected?
Very good point. We should have excess capacity in ventilators, as well as hospital beds, intensive care units, and all that, because the diseases that spread around the world are more likely to be respiratory diseases than to be bloodborne diseases, like Ebola. So those diseases move relatively slowly because they require contact with liquids, transfer of bodily fluids or whatever. To say that a lot of our worst diseases show respiratory symptoms in the victims, that's absolutely true, but you can look at it from the other end too. You can say that those diseases that cause respiratory symptoms are the ones that are most likely to spread around the world because they spread through the air. So any disease, whether it's the common cold, whether it's the year's influenza, whether it's COVID-19, any disease that spreads on the respiratory route, those are the ones that are most likely to be global pandemics. They might be highly virulent viruses killing a lot of people, or they might just be a relatively mild flu that spreads around the world, doesn't kill a very high percentage, but is extremely contagious. In either case, it makes sense to have excess capacity of ventilators. Why do we not have that excess capacity? Well, it's what I was talking about before. It's the fact that leaders, bureaucrats, are reluctant to spend money on excess capacity that may not be necessary, at least when it comes to healthcare. When it comes to military preparedness, we do it all the time. There's no excuse, really, for not having excess ventilators ready when a respiratory pandemic strikes.
What do you think dictates the levels of attention that we give to different topics in society? As in, why do you think a voter might be more inclined to voting for someone that builds excess capacity in the military sector but doesn't in the health sector?
Right. It's a curious thing. People have different thresholds for different kinds of risk. Some people say that people are reluctant to tolerate risk if it's something that they can't control. But if it's something that they can control, then they will tolerate risk. For instance, cigarette smoking. Everybody knows that that's risky. People still do it. People might be willing to tolerate the risk that they take by using tobacco, either cigarette smoking or chewing tobacco. It's dangerous. It can cause cancer. They tolerate that risk because they can choose it. But if you tell them grizzly bears, they're a threatened species and they're going to be protected by the endangered species list, and therefore there will be more grizzly bears that might be coming out of the mountains near their cows and their calves, possibly even where their children play, they will say that's absolutely unacceptable. I will not tolerate that risk. I will use chewing tobacco. I will drive my pickup truck down a gravel road at 75 miles an hour without wearing a seatbelt. That's risky, but I will not tolerate the risk of a grizzly bear near the place where I graze my cows. We all have anomalies like that. We all tolerate some kinds of risks and are unwilling to tolerate others. And that goes into our voting behavior, and not just our private consumer choices and lifestyle choices. It's irrational. It's something that we have to accept. People's attitude toward risk is not rational.
Something that I've been hearing here and there is that because of mutations and because of Darwinism, the coronavirus will eventually get weaker in order to survive in our system. But you also explain why that might not necessarily be the case. Is that going to be the case with coronavirus? Is it going to get weaker the more we go forward and learn how to coexist with us?
Well, you're right. That I explore that in Spillover, and people have heard that. Oh, viruses evolve to become less virulent, to become less vicious in the human body, and to become milder. Sometimes it happens, and sometimes it doesn't happen. It depends on the circumstances that the virus faces. So it remains to be seen what will happen with this virus. Coronaviruses are single-stranded RNA viruses, which means that they have a relatively high capacity to mutate, to evolve, to adapt. Not nearly as high as influenza viruses, which evolve very quickly for different reasons that I don't need to go into. But yes, this virus has the capacity to evolve. The evolutionary virologists that I've read so far on this are saying that this virus so far is not evolving, is not changing very much. Although it has a reasonably high mutation rate, is holding fairly steady in its genome to the way it was when it got into humans. Why would that be? Well, they say this virus doesn't need to evolve to be successful because this virus already happens to be so successful. It's spreading from human to human just great. It's gotten around the world in 2 months. It doesn't need to change its evolutionary strategy. It doesn't need to change its genome. It is succeeding. It will evolve more when it meets some challenges. What kind of challenges? Well, a vaccine, for instance. When we get a vaccine, that will be a challenge to the virus in terms of being able to transmit from one human to another. So with its relatively high mutation rate, it may evolve to get around the vaccine or to try to get around the vaccine. Influenzas do that. That's why we need a new influenza vaccine every year, because influenzas evolve so quickly. They can get around last year's vaccine. This virus is not going to evolve as fast as influenzas. And the scientists that I trust are saying that when we get a vaccine, that vaccine ought to be good for a while. It ought to be good for more than a year. But in terms of the virus evolving on its own to become less virulent, there's no reason to assume that that'll happen. Its life history strategy right now, and viruses do have a life history strategy, is working just fine. There is no reason to assume that this virus on its own is going to evolve to become less lethal than it is right now.
So not even by random chance?
It is randomly mutating all the time. There is plenty of random chance out there. It is throwing off different versions of itself every time it replicates. But unless there's an advantage in that particular change won't spread. It won't be selected by natural selection. As you say, it's Darwin. It's Darwin 101.
What I was really surprised about was reading in your book that the first SARS super spreader, a man named Professor Liu, started spreading the disease more than 2 weeks after he came in contact with the first SARS patient in southern China.
He was actually the second. He was the second super spreader. First super spreader was the poison king, the seafood merchant, from whom he probably got his case.
There you go. So in a way, we knew that with SARS, people were still spreading the disease even 2 weeks after they had encountered the disease for the first time. Mm-hmm. Now, why is it that the general assumption around the world is that the default time for self-quarantine is only 2 weeks? Why isn't it longer? If we know that with SARS, it happened to spread after 2 weeks.
The answer is that we don't know. That's just a guess. And you're right. It's a guess that will be tested and is being tested, but it's not a guess that's been produced by really solid, you know, laboratory experimental data and deductions from data. It's an emergency guess.
It sounds like a bad guess. We know that it happens that some patients go for more than 2 weeks.
But equally important is what you said about the silent spread. That didn't exist to any great degree with SARS. People spreading the virus before they felt symptoms. Even the man, Professor Liu, who carried the virus to Hong Kong, at which point he was very sick and he was coughing, maybe he was vomiting, and he was shedding virus. Obviously, he was symptomatic. But whether he was spreading virus for 2 weeks before that, we don't know. We don't think so until he became symptomatic. That was a difference between SARS, called SARS-1, and SARS-CoV-2, this virus. What makes this virus so successful in its own terms, in Darwinian terms, and so dangerous to us is this silent spread, this fact that people who are not yet symptomatic have been walking around, going to gatherings, riding the metro, going to work, and feeling fine, and yet they were shedding virus before they got sick. That is an extremely efficient strategy for a virus. And why does that happen? Well, they're just still speculating about this, but they're speculating that the first SARS primarily attacked respiratory cells in the lower respiratory tract. And so when people got very sick, then their lungs immediately started to fill because those cells were close to their lungs and their bronchiae, and they got crises and then coughing and vomiting and spreading the virus. But they weren't shedding virus before that because the cells were down low in their respiratory tract as the virus developed. Scientists are now speculating that this virus affects upper respiratory tract cells first, and from those cells, it can more easily spread not just on a horrible cough, but perhaps on an ordinary breath or on speech. And so people are walking around not feeling bad, but they've got virus replicating in their upper respiratory cells that are coming out of their mouths as they breathe and as they talk. That's what's so ingenious, quotation marks, about this particular virus.
This might sound like a rhetorical question to many, but is there a correlation between the way us as humans change the natural landscape and the number of new diseases that seem to be hitting us?
Absolutely. This disease is not an isolated event. This pandemic is not an isolated event. There have always been viruses coming from animals into people, but it seems to be happening more frequently now for a couple of reasons. And the first of those reasons is there are more humans, 7.7 billion humans now. We're hungry, we're smart, we're putting demands on the natural world for resources. We want timber, we want minerals, we want meat, we want water. We're putting all these demands on the natural world. We are coming in contact more and more with wild animals. Again, something that's always happened, but the scale now is different. All of those wild animals carry viruses. Some of those viruses are dangerous in humans. Some of them spill over into humans. And when they spill over into us because of the destruction that we're causing in the natural world, and they get into humans, then there's an opportunity. They get into us, first of all, because we are there and we represent an opportunity. The viruses don't seek us out. They just fall into us and they take hold, and that's an opportunity. If they can spread from one human to another, that's another opportunity. And it's a great opportunity for a virus because there are so many of us and we're so concentrated. We live so close together and we travel so much. So a virus that gets into a human can infect millions of bodies and spread around the world in a relatively short time. It begins with things that we're doing to the natural world: intrusion, destruction, consumption, and that causes the spillovers, and then the spillovers turn into epidemics or pandemics because of our connectedness.
What do you think is going to be the impact of coronavirus in Africa? There's a lot of talk about this right now.
I've been bracing myself for what's going to happen when this virus gets into the big chaotic cities of Central Africa, like Kinshasa of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or Brazzaville, or Harare. What's going to happen? I mean, the virus is already there, but it has been very minor so far. Not very many cases, not very many deaths. It seems to me that those places are just a big pile of dynamite waiting to blow up. And when that happens, I think it's going to be terrible for the people there. And I don't know why it hasn't happened yet. I feel like any day that we could start to see terrible numbers coming from Kinshasa. I hope it doesn't happen. If it doesn't happen, I have no idea why it's not happening, because it seems to me there's every reason to expect that it would happen. There are some brilliant scientific people. I know some of them. They're brilliant medical people, but they don't have the resources to control an outbreak like this if it really gets going.
Wouldn't it make sense for Western countries to help them with the resources in order to stop the pandemic? I mean, aren't we all in danger until we get it under control everywhere?
We absolutely are, but we've gotten so far behind the ball in places like Italy and the US now that it's difficult for us to imagine sending medical resources anywhere, especially under Donald Trump. You know, America first. That's a horrible idea because these diseases are so globalized. They go everywhere, and nobody is really safe and healthy unless and until everybody is safe and healthy, and we're nowhere near that. Wealthy countries should be able to send help in a situation like this to countries with less resources.
I mean, it sounds like it would be selfish altruism, to use an oxymoron.
Absolutely. Now, I was looking for the right phrase, but you're absolutely right. Selfish altruism, it would be right and good, but it would also be smart for us to be doing that for our own sake as well as the sake of the people in Kinshasa.
What do you think are some of the most dangerous assumptions that we're making as humanity?
The most dangerous assumption that we're making is that we can continue with globalized, consumptive growth economies indefinitely. We can continue multiplying our population and consuming resources at the rate that we are doing and saying, great, the economy grew by 3% last year. The global growth curve is up and the national GNP is up. Terrific. Our economies are booming. That's the most dangerous assumption we can make, that we can continue that indefinitely. Because I believe, along with a lot of other people who are watching the impacts on the natural world and the way those impacts feed back to us, we who are part of the natural world, we see the problems. We see the loss of biological diversity, the climate change, and the increased jeopardy of pandemic diseases. And those things all reflect the fact that we're saying we've got 7.7 billion people. We're headed toward 9 billion people. That's just fine. We're going to feed everybody. Everybody's going to have a cell phone. Everybody's going to have a new jacket. Everybody's going to have new gym shoes once a year or more. And everybody's going to be able to eat lots of meat. And everybody's going to be able to fly and drive everywhere they want. There's going to be oil and other resources, all we want. We can keep continuing what we're doing. That's the most dangerous assumption that we're making.
It also makes me think about something else that you say in the book, which is one of the things that contributes to a pandemic's success or failure is people's behavior. Like, our behavior doesn't impact our future in any way, which is ludicrous. How do you feel about that?
I mean, I think that's true. When you talk about controlling behavior, then is it a matter of governments controlling behavior or world organizations controlling behavior, or each of us controlling our own behavior in terms of the decisions that we make? There are all those levels. And I think that the most important level is the individual choices that we make. That's where it all has to begin, in terms of how we choose to consume, what we eat, what we wear, how much we drive, how much we fly, how many children we have, if we have children, how we vote, whether we vote with the idea of the future in mind and other people in mind, or whether we vote simply on the basis of, well, how is this going to affect my income next year? All of those individual choices, that's the most important kind of control of behavior, controlling our own behavior. But it's difficult because we have a lot of poor people and they are desperate for food. And we have a lot of working poor people who are angry and scared. In the U.S., for instance, there are a lot of working people whose real income has gone down over the last 30 years, and they're angry and they're worried, and they show it by voting for Donald Trump. So how do we solve that problem? I don't know.
It's almost like asking, how do you make a moderate version of capitalism? How do you slow capitalism down without making it collapse on itself?
And who is the model for that? Who is the model? Who is our exemplum for that? Is it Sweden? Is it Canada? I don't know. Those places are admirable in many ways. And yet, can you turn Canada into the U.S.? Can you turn Sweden into Russia? No, you can't do it. You know, we have to deal with the realities that we have, which is lots and lots of people, suspicion, worry, desperation, disempowerment, anger, hunger, the wealth differential. We have to deal with all of those things. But I don't want to sound gloomy, hopeless. We can do all this. We can do all this. We can get through this pandemic. Yes. Andrea Bocelli is still singing. People are still writing beautiful poetry and books and music and playing football, and also American football and baseball, and beautiful things are going on and people are able to hug each other. We'll get there. We'll get back to that. I hope we'll learn from this. I hope we'll learn from this, some of those bigger lessons in terms of our behavior.
That was a conversation with David Quammen, science writer and author of 4 books of fiction and 7 of nonfiction, including The Reluctant Mr. Darwin and The Song of the Dodo. He served as the Wallace Stegner Chair of Western American Studies at Montana State University. During this time period of the coronavirus, David Quammen is much in demand as writer for the New York Times and the New Yorker, and for online interviews. Thanks for this interview go to Almo Parenti, member of a collective of young filmmakers based in Milano, Italy. They spoke on April 23rd, 2020. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.